The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette. How's it going?
Good evening. How are you?
Good. I should really introduce us as criminal defense attorney Aida Leisenring and criminal defense attorney Bruce Barquette, because we are going to talk all things on our side of the fence today.
We are. We do more than those two things or that one thing, but we are going to chat a little bit tonight about being a criminal defense attorney and some of the big questions that we get asked all the time. We've never discussed this on the show, so I think it's a good idea.
And I think we have the perfect guest at the second half of the hour, who is an expert insider for sure. He's a criminal defense attorney who has, in some circles these days, become a legal outcast because of the politics behind one of his cases. Attorney Joe McBride will be joining us. He represents one of the U.S. Capitol protesters, and not just any protester, but the one who made it into Nancy Pelosi's office and famously put his feet up on the desk.
Mr. Barnett, not to be confused with Mr. Barquette.
Correct. Big O. He has a nickname, Big O. I don't know what your nickname.
I don't do nicknames.
There was one nickname I won't mention during a 6 month trial we had that the media gave you, but we won't go there. But Joe McBride's been vilified by the left, applauded by the right, all of because of whom he represents. And he's been going on a lot of TV shows, and he himself, as a lawyer, is becoming the news. He was on CNN to discuss his client's case, and he was arguably mocked and smirked at by host John Avalon, who clearly was not a neutral journalist at that moment, and really just hated who he represented. And we represent all sorts of people, right?
We do.
And cases.
We do. And we're going to talk about this as the show goes along. But when you're representing somebody who's in trouble because of their political beliefs, it's a little bit different than simply representing someone who's done a bad thing that they either deny doing or are sorry for having committed. When you're representing somebody whose motivation was political, oftentimes that person thinks what they did was morally correct, although technically illegal, and then you run into problems, or you can run into problems as a lawyer, because you're advocating not for the individual's rights under the law, but advocating for the individual's politics, and that's always a problem.
Well, and it used to be that people got angry that you were representing someone alleged to have murdered another, but now it takes a lot less.
The politics of it. The politics of it always are adds a little bit to it. And look, we had Ron Kuby on, who's represented people on the left, and we're going to have Joe McBride tonight. But I want to start with what's going to be a little bit more of a somber note, and actually a much more somber note. For those of us on Long Island, everyone has heard of the horrific accident that took place in Quag over the weekend. Quag is part of the Hamptons, for those who aren't from around here, and five individuals died in a horrific crash, including two brothers, Michael Farrell and James Farrell, one of their best friends, Ryan Geis. The driver who left behind Farhan Zahid, who left behind a wife and three children, ages 1 to 6, as well as the driver of another car, Justin Mendez. A horrible tragedy, and I have to say I know the families of the three men, James Farrell, Michael Farrell, and Ryan Geis. And I bring this up because they think it's too early to know for sure if drugs or alcohol played a role, but everyone suspects that. It seems that excessive speed certainly contributed to it, given the horrific nature of the crash. It's a difficult thing to talk about as a criminal defense lawyer, and obviously we do more than criminal defense. Sometimes we represent accident victims, sometimes we represent victims of sex abuse. But we also represent people charged with crimes similar to this. And I can think of cases that you have handled, that I've handled, that our firm has handled, where somebody has met a horrific death in a car accident because of alcohol, and we were representing the person charged. And we've never talked about this in the show, but I want to talk about it tonight, which is how can we represent these individuals? How do we represent these people? And you go first.
Oh.
How do you do it?
How do I do it? I'll tell you this. When the thought first was planted in my head, my mom was a photographer and she was doing a lot of fashion photography. And then she started doing more journalistic photography and she was capturing a lot of individuals that were suspected to be gang members. She also started to do more musicians and more people on the street. And I was still a teenager and I would see these individuals and get to know them who had done jail time, who had violent assault convictions, but I didn't see that side of them. I saw their humanity. And I realized how a lot of people have had a difficult life. They haven't been properly educated. They have issues with anger management because they're poor. They've been beaten. And they don't have the language and armor to defend themselves or explain what they're going through. So I wanted to be an advocate for the underdog. And I think I've always had that my whole life. And what better way to do that than by being a criminal defense lawyer? So I started off as a public defender representing indigent individuals. And I took so much pride doing that in Brooklyn because a lot of public defenders get a lot of heat. Oh, you're just a legal aid. You don't know what you're doing. Public defenders have law degrees. Some of them are better than any private lawyer.
Some
of them are worse, right? It's like take your pick of a doctor in an ER. And I didn't want to judge these individuals. I wanted to uphold the Constitution, make sure they weren't being overly sentenced, and in cases where they were innocent, make every attempt possible to get their cases dismissed. And each case is unique. Each person has their own story. And then, you know, going into the private world, I've been able to participate in quite a few exonerations with you, and that's been magnificent. But a lot of what we do is also taking pleas, right?
It is. And it's funny that you mention the underdog because, you know, I started my career as a prosecutor.
I would have hated you if I had met you then, but I was probably 3 years old. No.
you certainly weren't a lawyer at that time. Look, I was a prosecutor. I was good at it. I was aggressive. I carried out the district attorney's policies with all the energy and enthusiasm I could muster. But after doing it for a few years, I got to the point where I just didn't feel good about representing the government against an individual. It may not have been expressed exactly that way at the time, but I just didn't want to do it anymore. I felt much more comfortable representing an individual who's really an underdog the moment they get arrested, no matter how much money they have, no matter how much political power they had, no matter what their position was.
David and Goliath.
The moment that they get arrested, they become David. The moment they get arrested. And representing an individual against the government is just enormously more satisfying to me. And I've had experiences from both sides. I can also say this. I'm a Catholic. I'll get a little personal. I'm a Catholic. And I do this work not in spite of my faith, not on the side of my faith, but in large part because of it. I actually think that this is the work that God would have me do. And I actually think I'm going to go out on a limb here and say if Jesus were around today and a lawyer, he would not be standing at the front table pointing an accusatory finger demanding punishment. He'd be standing at the back table as a public defender, I dare say, defending the accused, seeking mercy for the convicted. And to me, that's the most powerful image that I can come up with. And as you said, we also participate in the exoneration of people who are innocent. And that is just a spectacular thing to fight for somebody who you believe to be innocent and eventually win their freedom.
And those are scary trials. I mean, I feel the weight of the entire world. I don't think I sleep while we're presiding over really any case, but particularly those. And sometimes, you know, I would get grief from prosecutors and they would say, you know, how can you do what you do? And I would turn to them and say, you're welcome. I get you the plea. I analyze the case. I talk the client into it if he's guilty. I, you know, work it out with you to get a reasonable offer. And sadly, considering that, you know, 98% of cases result in pleas, they don't happen just because there's one side of the law. They happen because there's a judge, there's a possible jury down the hall that's about to start the case, and there's a defense lawyer that's hopefully done the best job they can to make this go through.
So let's get some input from the listeners. If anybody wants to call in on this topic, we'd be happy to hear from you. The number is 631-451-1039. Again, the phone number is 631-451-1039. We have about a few minutes left in this segment, so if you want to chat about this, feel free to give us a call.
If you want to call and yell at us, we're used to it.
Or call and chat with us.
We get yelled at by everyone. Clients, clients' family members, judges, prosecutors, court officers.
we do pretty well. We have good work. It's very satisfying. And most of the people that we interact with, I think, appreciate the work that we do. One thing you mentioned, that when people are guilty, so another question, how do you represent these people, is one question we obviously always get. The other is, do you care if the person actually did it? Do you care? Does it matter to us individually if the person actually did it?
Well, does a doctor care if you actually, you know, smoke cigarettes, you know, ingested alcohol before your surgery? Of course it matters.
Right.
But it doesn't matter from a moral standpoint. It does. But in terms of the job that we're doing, it matters because we're going to be assessing the case and what we think is an appropriate and reasonable offer, or whether or not we should go to trial, whether or not the person can testify. Right?
I'll tell you. Here's my take on it. Legally, it matters because you can't claim that somebody is innocent if you know that they're guilty. Right, you can argue that there's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but you can't claim that they're innocent if you know that they're guilty. Practically, it matters significantly because I can't find the real killer if the real killer's sitting at our conference table with us, right? And it would be a colossal waste of time and resources to kind of track down tips of who might have committed the crime if your client did it. You're better off preparing a good cross-examination, good arguments at trial, in order to try to prevail in that context rather than wasting time looking for somebody who doesn't exist. And I'll say this, that it also matters to me, at least morally, because whether or not the person did it doesn't determine whether or not they should get punished or how severely. Right, and I'll go back to can I go back to my seminary roots again?
Only if you're going to tell the full story about how you were going to become a priest at one point.
It's something that I considered, but I'll do this. The adulteress in the Bible who was about to be stoned to death was clearly guilty of adultery, clearly guilty, and she was meeting the punishment that was appropriate at the time for her crime. And when Christ stood between her and those who would stone her to death, he didn't say, oh, did you do it? Did you not do it? If you did it, then you're going to have to get hit with one stone or many stones or something. He simply interceded on her behalf and got for her mercy, leniency, essentially gave her a pass. And sometimes people deserve a pass, even though they've done something wrong. And to me, that's important to recognize, that the ultimate justice of what takes place, should a person be convicted, should they get punished, how severely, is something that, as humans, we don't have a certain answer to all the time.
Well, and take the case of doctors, right? They get good people in the ER and they get bad people in the ER. And sometimes the people they get are people that just shot somebody and they're there in cuffs. the doctor doesn't say, am I going to save this person or not? Right? He says, what do I have to do to make him better? He doesn't judge him. And in that sense, it's weird that our actual law degrees are called juris doctorates. We're not doctors, obviously. They're the really smart people. But I would never want to judge somebody whose shoes I have not walked in. And I mean, believe me, we make judgments all the time and it's human to judge. But I try not to. And I also, I think with time, I start thinking more about the victims. In a lot of our cases, it's not clear who the victims are because it's more of a what happened, right? There's a dispute and a debate over what happened. So your client may have been guilty of some of the conduct, but not all of the conduct, and the complainant might be lying. And that's what we try to get to the bottom of, right?
But sometimes it is clear who
but
the victim is.
But I've sat at sentencings where I've sobered up, so to speak, upon hearing the survivors of the deceased talk about how this case and how the court appearances have impacted them. And that is a very sobering experience that every defense lawyer should participate in.
You know, it's a good thought. And one of these coming weeks, I think that we'll spend some time on air, potentially with the family members of a victim of a horrific crime. I think that'd be good for people to hear. I think it's a good perspective to have. It's something that as attorneys we shouldn't run from or hide from. We have to recognize that there are real victims of crime, even as we're representing the people that are accused of committing those crimes. Very important. Look, at the end of the day, and you know my kind of theme, which is that we defend the accused. Everyone needs and is entitled to a lawyer. We seek mercy for those condemned or convicted, and we get to participate in the exoneration of the innocent from time to time. And that's what we do, and I'm thrilled with doing it. And I'll end this little segment with another kind of a prayer or expression of grief and sorrow for those five individuals who died over the weekend in Quorum. It was horrible to hear about it, and I can't imagine how the parents, these were young men in their 20s who had their whole life in front of them, who met an untimely death in a car accident. So we'll stop there. You have a less somber story to tell. Can you do it in...
I don't know if I can do it in 3 minutes, but I'll try. Maybe it'll only take 2 minutes. So Mark Furnish, if I'm pronouncing his name right, he's kind of a high-profile lawyer these days. He represented Epstein. He represents Keith Raniere.
We know him, right? We met
right.
him.
Keith Raniere, who's the leader of NXIVM, the alleged sex trafficking cult. So he's dealing with a restitution hearing with his client, and the client says, I need more time to speak. I haven't had enough time to speak to my lawyers. And I guess there was an issue with timing. So Furnish asked Judge, how do you pronounce it? Judge Garifas.
I think that's correct.
Garifas. He asked Judge Garifas for...
ask me how to pronounce anything.
No, I really shouldn't. That's just absolutely ridiculous. But anyway, so he asked him more for more time. We've been here. We're not ready today. We need an extra day, or can we come back next week? And quite frequently, a judge will give us a really hard time about this. So this turned out to just be awkward, and I kind of wish I had been in the courtroom watching it. But Furnish had a funeral he had to go to. It was from an esteemed colleague, someone in the Bar Association. And I take it was another attorney. And he asked for more time, and I think the judge said, you asked me to delay the proceedings to attend the funeral, but you have Claire Brofman paying your fees, and you couldn't go see your client before the hearing. They basically got in an argument, and Furnish said at the very end, yes, I have something to add. I can't believe you brought up the funeral. This funeral was for an esteemed member of the bar. I resent what you did. And the judge turns to him and he looks at the clerk to mock him, and he offers Furnish a Kleenex and adds, give this to him so he can go cry.
Ooh.
And so Furnish got really angry and he said, I resent what you're doing. This is disgraceful. This violates human decency and professional courtesy. The judge gets angry and he shouts, be seated or I'll have you arrested. Furnish says, you should be the one arrested. This is disgraceful. And then there's this awkward, glaring, staring game silence between them. And the judge finally says, stare at me all you want. And Furnish goes, same to you. And they sat there quietly for 30 minutes.
So this didn't take place in a courtroom. It took place in a schoolyard.
Right. And the judge says to Furnish, you know, you're asking for a delay, but I'm from Queens. I know how long it takes to commute to the funeral and back. And he goes, false. He said, there'd be a shiva after the funeral. The judge, be quiet. Judge, you're interrupting me every time. I've never seen anything like this. And Furnish says, neither have I. And the client's sitting there like, what's going on?
And you know, this is what we do. We go from the somber and the horrible to the absurd and the sublime.
But it ends with, judge, sorry for losing my temper, Furnish said. And the judge ended with, I'm sorry for your loss. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. My name is Aida Leisenring. I'm here with Bruce Barquette. And we have on the line attorney Joseph McBride of the McBride Law Firm here in the city. He started off interning at the Innocence Project, where I was once an intern. And then he started his career at the Legal Aid Society of Manhattan. And he currently represents Richard Biggo Barnett. And for those of you that don't know him by name, you know him by his long legs resting on Nancy Pelosi's desk. He has been called brave by New York Post Miranda Devine. He's been heavily criticized by CNN, applauded by Newsmax, canceled on LinkedIn for his hashtag, which he started, hashtag DC Gitmo. Welcome, Cho. How you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And I have to say, like, as we were talking about this earlier on our first half hour, we received angry text messages from Marty Tankliff, and he tried to correct us. He said, it's not Nancy's desk. It is the taxpayer's desk that she uses.
True indeed.
Yeah, not so true.
Well, she doesn't get to take it back home with her at the end of her, you know, career.
It may be temporary possession while she's in office, but while she's the speaker, it's her desk, not his.
So, Joe, tell us, how is your client Richard Barnett doing? How is he feeling right now?
Richard is doing as best as anyone can do under house arrest. He, you know, wants to work. He was fired from his previous employer because of his arrest and his connection to the events, you know, on January 6th. We have tried to get the court to allow him to travel more frequently for work. He lives in the mountainous region of Arkansas, so the closest city is Fayetteville, about 50 or 60 miles away, but anything else after that is 100 or 200 miles. He's a country boy living in the country, and each time we need to get him to someplace for work to buy or sell or purchase something for his business, we need to get permission from the court, which is it's a real pain in the butt, and it does not allow him to react to sales of cars and their parts in a timely manner. And it also forces us to announce his whereabouts to the world. So because of this, he has not been able to make a whole lot of money since he's been home.
But I assume, Joe, sorry to cut you off, I assume that where he is now is better than where he was?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's better than being in solitary confinement in a gulag, that's for sure.
When you say the gulag, you mean the D.C. Federal Detention Facility?
Yeah, we're calling it D.C. Gitmo, Bruce, because American citizens are being held there pre-trial. And most of them are people who have had no prior contact with the criminal justice system whatsoever. They're not flight risk. They're not dangerous. They're being held there nonetheless. And while being held there, they're held in 23-hour lockdown, 24-hour lockdown, and are enduring conditions that no human being should have to endure, never mind somebody who has not yet been.
Tell us about the conditions, because this is something that we take up regularly with the local detention facilities here in New York, MCC and MDC. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
So this facility has a long history, a dubious history of just being unsanitary, unkempt, unclean, not up to date, not up to par, just in general. When the J6ers were coming in, they opened up a new wing. They labeled it the Patriot Wing, but it is a defunct wing that hadn't been opened in a number of years. Black mold, brown water, poor ventilation, you name it, it's happening there. And they stuck all these guys in there from Jump Street. So the living conditions in and of themselves are cause for major concern.
And do
never mind the fact that...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Do they get any recreational time?
So most of them get about an hour a day.
But that hour isn't that hour for, like, make a phone call to your lawyer, take a shower, or wait in the line for the phone? I mean, what happens during that 1 hour?
Right. It all really depends on what you need to do. Do you need to go to the shower? Do you need to call your loved one? Do you need to speak to somebody else who's in one of the other cells? It's 1 hour to get it all done most of the times. Now, there are times where on certain days, every now and again, they're given additional time, but the majority of these guys are 23 hours a day. And if you speak out and if you say, hey, the handbook says you can't do this or you have to do that, they take you and they put you in the box. They put you in a hole. And some people have been left there for weeks or months at a time.
The conditions, everything else aside, the conditions at these federal detention facilities, and it sounds like D.C. is very much like MCC and MDC in New York, are horrific. There's no excuse for treating individuals this way. No excuse for the black mold and brown water, which we've heard about at MCC, for the insect and rodent infestation. It really is despicable that we allow our government to treat our citizens that way, pre-trial or post-trial.
Right. But the crazy thing is, it's the pre-trial facilities that tend to be the worst.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's where people who are allegedly presumed innocent are staying.
So I want to jump to a different topic if I can, Joe. And one of the reasons why I thought it was a great idea to have you on, in addition to the good work that you're doing for this individual, regardless of the politics, is to talk about how it is for a lawyer to represent an individual in a political case, right? So you don't have a defense that he didn't do it or he was, you know, in Arkansas when this happened. And it doesn't sound like he's all that sorry for his criminal conduct. And you have this underlying political movement that's behind it. How do you, as a lawyer, navigate that?
Well, you navigate it by putting the truth before you. So with regard to his state of mind then or his state of mind now, I don't want to really touch on that too much. What we can say is that we do have multiple defenses to every crime to which he has been charged, especially the crime of violent entry. Violent entry presupposes that you were violent and that you use your own volition to enter into the building.
Just to back up, a lot of people are saying your client had a stun gun, but my understanding is that it was actually a cane that could double as one, but it had been turned off and was never used.
That's correct. It was a multi-use tool, walking stick, stun gun device with a flashlight on it. The batteries were not operating at that time. They had failed the day before. They were never replaced. That is indicated by video of him the day before. And when the batteries are operating, there's a white light that emanates from that walking stick. And when the stun gun is armed, there's a red light that emanates. On January 6th, I've been given hundreds of videos, hundreds of pictures, hours and hours of all this stuff. And not at any point in time do you see that light on. Or is that stick glowing? That's because the batteries were off and the stun gun portion of that instrument was rendered ineffective.
And I got us off from the original question Bruce was asking, and that's what we want to talk to you about. How much grief have you taken in the legal community, in your own community, through strangers, you know, Twitter, news outlets? How much grief have you personally gotten for taking on this case?
A monumental amount of grief, but I counted the cost before I got involved. It's unfortunate, but I became a lawyer because my brother Anthony was wrongfully convicted for a crime he absolutely did not do. He was sentenced to 15 years of incarceration for nothing. So I know what it's like to have my hand, my family's life in the hands of an inadequate attorney. So, you know, as I came up through the Innocence Project and then at Legal Aid, when I was at Legal Aid, one of the things you would hear from people all the time is the famous statement, how can you defend those people? How can you defend somebody who's a repeat offender, who steals or who does this? And I would say, look,
so tell us, like, how can you defend this individual who clearly, I think it's fair to say, went into the building with the hopes to disrupt the natural political process of installing Joe Biden?
Your question assumes facts, not in evidence, Mr. Barquette. How can he represent someone?
Let him answer the question. Let him answer the question. How do you represent him?
I disagree with you with every fiber of my soul and being. And if I could underscore that and highlight that, let me do that as well. At no point in time did my client, did Mr. Barnett, have any desire to thwart any process at all. He showed up to protest.
Protest what?
The election results. He thought the election was a sham.
Okay. That's the question. But how do you represent him with, given that belief, given that the motivation for his conduct was political? It wasn't greed. It wasn't that he wanted money. He didn't want to get on TV. He wasn't doing it for some sexual reason. He wasn't angry with somebody to kill them or assault them. He did it for a political motive. And then you come in, and I don't think it matters what your politics are unless you want to tell us, but how do you end up representing an individual with that kind of political motivation for his conduct?
Look, I mean, it's the Constitution. It's the First Amendment of the United States. I mean, how can you not represent somebody who shows up to protest against the government and then is thrown in jail because of it? I get the fact where he ended up. And look, a few days in jail may be reasonable, but months in jail, months in the box, getting abused, slapped around, dragged. I mean, how is that okay? This has far-reaching consequences for the First Amendment in this country, for political protests in this country. And I feel compelled to get involved because the erosion of Miranda, the erosion of the First Amendment, I'm not a sit on the sidelines kind of lawyer and just let this stuff happen.
And Miranda, for listeners, is, you know, your right to remain silent, right to have an attorney, et cetera, that I think you're alleging he was violated. By the way, he's facing 10 years, right? If he went to trial, he lost, he went down. How much time is he actually facing?
Statutorily, he could get like 11 years on the guidelines.
Which is pretty crazy, for doing something stupid and not hurting anyone. But do you think because he has that famous shot, he's going to suffer more severe consequences? Because two people just got sentenced. I had never heard of them. One got 8 months in jail, which isn't nothing, but it isn't as, you know, drastic as one would imagine. And another woman, I think, just got 3 years probation. Do you see that as a possible sentence if he were to plead guilty or lose at trial? Or do you see the 11 years being closer to that?
No, I don't see the 11 years. Look, I see the Constitution and truth winning in the end. This is a glorified trespass. It was a bad day. We all know what happened that day, but he had no intent to disrupt any election, and he had no intent to even end up inside of the Capitol building. It happened, but he wasn't part of a cohort. He didn't plan anything. There's no evidence of that. No evidence of that will come out because it simply does not exist. He went to protest that day, a 60-year-old man, no criminal record of any kind, a patriot, a guy who loves his country, yes, he ended up in there, but come on, multiple years in jail, it's ridiculous.
How did, so, Joe, how did this guy from the hills of Arkansas find you? I mean, we know you. You're a pit bull and a quality lawyer. Yeah. How did he find you? Or how did you find him?
Well, word of mouth inside of the D.C. Facility. A colleague of mine, Stephen Metcalf, represents Jacob Lang. And Jacob Lang, you know, spoke to Old Big O. And when people were shopping around looking for lawyers at the beginning of this, you know, they wanted to know who was good, who was reputable, who will go hard, who will go all in, despite the allegations. And my name came up, and I was able to, you know, come to terms.
Oh, good for you. I mean, and good for you and good for him. Regardless of whether or not people agree with the politics, I think everyone can agree that Mr. Barnett deserves a good and vigorous defense, somebody who will stand up and defend him in court and speak up for him. And it's good that you're doing that, and I know it's not easy.
So let's talk about the CNN interview.
No. You want to talk about that or the interview on Russian TV?
Oh, we'll get to the Russian TV one. We still have like 5 minutes, 55 seconds. But so you were on CNN, and I pretty much don't watch TV anymore, so I don't know who this host was. I think his name is John Avalon. Is that right?
Yeah, John Avalon.
And so you're on there, and you're there like invited on the show to legitimately talk about like what's happening with Capitol protesters' cases, I assume. And I watched this guy. I've never watched him before, but he's snickering, smirking, like, and asking you questions as if you're the defendant. He's like, who did you vote for? What is your politics? Do you think the election is stolen? These are insurrectionists. Don't you agree with that? What was it like being on there?
Look, people ask me, like, why are you going on CNN? Like, you know, like how they believe and what they're going to do and the kind of stuff that they're pumping out. And my response is, look, I believe that liberals, just like conservatives, in their heart, there's a good space in their heart where they believe that solitary confinement is wrong, where they believe that abuse is wrong, where they believe that only the guilty and not the innocent should be incarcerated. So I go on to try to win hearts and minds if I can. Now,
and that's why New York Post calls you brave.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I do. You know, I knew it could potentially be argumentative at times. I had been on CNN before, and it was a fair, like, sort of going back and forth in a difficult exchange, but a productive one. I did not expect him to, you know, impugn me, to go after me personally, to ask me about my beliefs. It's obviously highly inappropriate. Just because somebody commits a murder and then an attorney defends that person, it does not mean that the attorney condones murder and or any other crime. This is our job. We put ourselves in the shoes of our client to zealously advocate for our clients as best as we know how. So for him to talk about me, look, it's the wrong thing to do. I think the world saw it for what it is, that the outpouring of support that I got after that interview is really telling as to how upset and how done the public is with people like John Avalon.
But that interview, I think, is exactly why it's interesting to speak to somebody representing an individual in a political case, because you're going to get those questions. People are going to ask that. No one thinks that you support murder. If you're representing somebody charged with murder, they think you're going to say he didn't do it, or he had a good excuse for it, or he shouldn't be punished harshly for it, something like that. Well, but the political motivation calls upon you for a different skill set to defend the case and, in a way, defend the beliefs, if you can.
So let's talk about...
Look.
Let's talk about Russia. Speaking of politics.
We'll get to Russia in 1 second. Just let me respond to
of
that.
Of course.
In a post-9/11 world, we're all New Yorkers, and we all remember what happened on September 11th. On a post-9/11 world, if you were defending a religious Muslim, right, people did not like that. People were like, how could you defend those people? They attacked us. They are terrorists, but brave souls who were willing to deal with whatever crap was going to come their way stood up for these people because they were being charged by the United States in the United States, they were entitled to due process of some kind. So good lawyers stood up and said, hey, I will defend these people if no one else will.
Exactly. And we had one of those lawyers on 2 weeks ago who's representing people in Guantanamo Bay. So we get it. It's a great thing that you're doing and from that perspective.
The boogeyman always has a different face, a different look, right? And, you know, who we vilified in the 40s to the 50s to the 60s to today, 2021, is always going to be a changing face. And as a criminal defense lawyer, you need to protect the law.
Okay. Now, tell us, why did you go on Russian TV?
Oh, well, number one, it's a free country, right?
It is, but you also get to make, you're also free to say no.
Yeah, no, I went because of DC Gitmo, because of the Gulag, because people are being thrown into prison pre-trial for political reasons. And that is something that the Soviet Union used to do on a regular basis. We have been screaming out from the mountaintops about the impropriety of all this, about how this is wrong. And liberal organizations who have been on the record for years saying that this kind of thing is wrong, condemning it outright, senators like Elizabeth Warren, organizations like the UN, the ACLU, are silent. And then you have people from the right who are silent as well. So if the media and if the government isn't going to hold itself accountable and if people aren't going to speak out about it, my decision was to go and speak to the Russians and say, hey, what used to happen with you guys is now happening over here. How do you feel like that? Shame on you, USA.
Joe,
that's why I went to it.
We have to wrap it up, but first of all, of course, you're a friend, so I respect you and know you well, but a lot of criminal defense lawyers would not stand up for these guys. So thanks for coming on our show. Thanks for talking to us about it.
Thanks for the work.
My pleasure. All the best, guys.
Bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.